So we're now drawing to a close in our series on the lives of the prophets Elijah and Elisha. There are just three sermons left after this one, all essentially marking the end of an era. The first will see Israel's long-time antagonist, Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, replaced in a coup by one of his officials, Hazael. The second sermon will deal with the removal of Jehoram, king of Israel, in another coup by one of his army commanders, Jehu. And the third and final sermon will tackle the death of Elisha himself. And although at least 45 years lie between the accession of Jehu and the death of Elisha, we are told nothing of his acts during that whole time. In fact, all the biblical accounts of his ministry would seem to sit within the 12-year reign of Jehoram. And this emphasizes once again the importance of the house of Ahab in the history of the northern kingdom of Israel. We noted at the beginning of this series how the 36 years of the reigns of Ahab and his two sons, Ahaziah and Jehoram, take up two-thirds of the whole narrative of the northern kingdom, even though they only represent about one-seventh of the total time. And it's during this period, the reigns of these kings, that we hear of the acts of Elijah and Elisha. For once the last of Ahab's line, Jehoram, and his mother, Ahab's wife Jezebel, are killed by Jehu, nothing more is heard of these great prophets, save the death of Elisha all those years later. And we also saw how this great emphasis on these years coincided with Israel's greatest apostasy, their greatest turning away from God, as they adopted the worship of the foreign gods, Baal and Asherah. For before Ahab, no king had promoted the worship of Baal, and after Jehoram, no king was to do so again, until the destruction of the northern kingdom many years later. So as rebellion against God increased, so did God's intervention through his prophets. And we're reminded in this of that verse in Romans 5, where it says, "Now the law came in to increase the trespass, but where sin increased, grace abounded all the more. For as the sin of the nation of Israel reaches its highest point, so God's grace is seen to increase as well." And we've seen that throughout the passages that we have studied. So, for example, right at the beginning of it all, as God responded to Ahab's introduction of Baal worship by withholding the rain for 3.5 years and setting up that extraordinary scene on Mount Carmel, for the purpose of it all was to demonstrate to the people of Israel that Baal was no god at all. For despite his followers' claim that he was the rain god, the fertility bringer, no rain ever came, and no fertility was found in the land. And despite their claim that he was the god of lightning, of heavenly fire, nothing came down from heaven in response to his servants' frantic pleas to set light to the sacrifice below. No, instead it was Yahweh, God himself, who withheld and then gave back the rain, and who sent down fire to consume the sacrifice of Elijah. And this was all an act of grace. For if the people persisted in their rejection of God, in their worship of Baal, then they would inevitably be destroyed as a result of God's justice. But if they listened instead to these clear demonstrations of his reality, then so he would forgive and restore them to himself. And so all those acts of God that we've looked at in 1 and 2 Kings are all acts of grace as well as judgment. From the confrontation on Mount Carmel to the repeated rescuing of Israel from the attacks of its neighbor Syria, for they were all demonstrations to the people of God's reality. But if these were all acts on a national scale, we also have the record of many signs of God's grace on a much more intimate level, and never more so in the life than in the life of this Shunammite woman who appears in our passage this evening. For one of the major themes of both Elijah and Elisha's ministry is that alongside all those great world-changing events are all these accounts of much more personal interactions between God and individuals. And in this evening's passage, we return again to the life of this woman of Shunem, whom we first met in chapter 4. And her life, as recorded in these pages, has much to tell us about how God interacts with his people, with those who seek to serve and follow him. For the Bible is here to tell us primarily about God and how he relates to us, and not about ourselves. So what can we learn of God in the life of this Shunammite? We don't actually know when she became a believer, but when we first meet her back in 2 Kings 4, she's living in the town of Shunem, to the north of Samaria and the southwest of the Sea of Galilee. We discovered that she is married and to an old man, although we're not told how old she was herself, and they have no children. She's also described as being wealthy. Her first encounter with Elisha is to offer him a meal when the prophet visits Shunem. After this, she continues to feed him whenever he passes through, presumably as he travels around Israel ministering to all those who continue to worship God. After a while, this hospitality is upgraded to include the provision of a room in which the prophet could rest and work. She, by this stage, had recognized him as a holy man of God and therefore worthy of her increased and continued support. In response, Elijah asks her whether there's anything in any way that he can do to help her, in particular by using his influence with the king or his number two, the commander of the army. For in such a monarchy, the ultimate authority in matters of patronage or law or administration lay with such men. But she replies that she is content as she is, living amongst her own community and without any need of help from the court. However, Elisha's servant, Gehazi, points out to his master that the couple have no children, with little hope of any to come in the normal run of things, since the husband is old, and with each passing year, the chances of a successful pregnancy will be getting smaller and smaller. But God is not limited by statistical decline, and so Elisha is authorized to promise a son within the year. And sure enough, the next spring, a boy arrives. Sometime later, at a point when the boy is old enough at least to walk and find his way to his father in the fields, he's struck down with an illness that leads to his death, although we're told nothing of its nature, save that it involved serious pain in his head. He dies in his mother's lap at home. She then places his body on the bed in Elisha's room and hurries off to Mount Carmel, which was probably the location of one of his teaching schools where those so-called sons of the prophets received their instruction. On the way, she puts off the inquiries of both her husband and Gehazi with those simple word, shalom, the Hebrew word for peace, translated in our Bibles as it is well, probably used by her to mean more nothing that need trouble you, rather than that everything was fine in her heart. For her inner distress is obvious to Elisha when she fell at his feet at Carmel. She then, in her anguish, rebukes the prophet for giving her a son, only to thus take him away again so soon. However, she also believes in her heart that if anything is to be done, then it will only be done through Elisha himself, for she refuses to accompany Gehazi as he has sent ahead to try to bring the boy back to life, but instead sticks like glue to the prophet. When they return to Shunem, Elisha goes alone into his room and does indeed restore the boy's life, calling in the Shunammite once he has done so. She first falls again at Elisha's feet before picking up her son and leaving the room. Sometime later, we're not told exactly how long, Elisha, presumably during another of his visits to Shunem, tells the woman that a famine is coming on the land. As a result, she is instructed to leave Shunem, indeed leave Israel, and move somewhere else for the famine's 7-year duration. Now, she had a bit of a choice on this front, for Elisha does not specify which country she should go to. She could go south into Judah, north to the region of Tyre and Sidon, or east to Syria, Ammon, or Moab. However, she chose instead to go southwest into Philistine territory, perhaps because at the time it was the most hospitable to believers, with the rulers of Judah and Tyre and Sidon being at this time related to that persecutor, Jezebel, and the lands to the east being the traditional enemies of Israel. Whereas by contrast, at this date, Philistia had ceased to be the threat that it had been in the past in the time of Saul and David. She took with her what is described as her household in our passage. Now, we're not told whether this included her husband, as well as her son and any other dependents such as servants, although it is probable that her husband died either before or during the 7 years of famine, since it's unlikely that he would not have been present when she and her son visited the royal court at the end of our passage. Once the 7 years were up, she returns to Israel to find that in the intervening period, her house and land were no longer her own. Now, again, we're not told of the circumstances behind this. It might be that they'd been appropriated by the state once she'd left, but it's also possible that a neighbour had seized them, or that she'd left them in the care of another when she left and found that that individual refused to return them. But it's also possible that she sold them before she left with the understanding that she could buy them back on her return. At the very moment when she arrives at the royal court, Elisha's servant Gehazi is regaling the king with stories of his master's deeds. And he's just got to the point in Elisha's life where he raises the Shunammite's son back to life. Her timing couldn't have been better. And with that amazing story fresh in his mind, the king looks favourably upon her request and delegates one of his officials to arrange for the complete restoration of house and land, together with the proceeds from agriculture for the 7 years that she's been away. Presumably, the woman then returns to Shunem with her son and her dependents to take up residence once more. But we hear no more of her within the pages of the Bible. So now that we've rehearsed the biography of this woman, we return to our earlier question. What does it tell us about God? Well, the starting point is to realise that it tells us that God is very much interested in individuals. This surely has to be the main reason why we get all these curious little personal stories within the books of 1 and 2 Kings. After all, the book's titles would suggest they're meant to be primarily about national events, the stories of the rulers of Israel and Judah, the history of two countries over a period of about 500 years. But time and again, they seem to go off message and give us instead snapshots into the lives of much less important people. But always the people involved are God's people, whether it be conversion stories such as that widow of Zarephath or Naaman, or perhaps might be what we might call the equivalent of church history with those sons of the prophets, or as here, just individual believers. And the point we're to take from this is a very simple one. While God does indeed steer the course of history and make for the rise and the fall of nations and kings and empires, he is just as much working in the lives of individuals to draw them to himself and then grow and care for them like the good shepherd that he is. For he's not just interested in, but is actually controlling every moment of our everydays, every bit as much as he is the history of the whole world. And once we've grasped that everything that happens to us and in us is by the will of God, then there's much more to understand and take on board from this passage of relevance to our everyday lives. For if God really is in control of our every moment, and in the Bible he makes it very clear that he is, then we need to read narratives like this in the light of that truth. For the story of this Shunammite woman helps to illustrate for us some of the things that God does in people's lives, including our own. But we will not see that if we only read the Bible from the point of view of the humans within it. So, for example, if we were to read of this woman and think, how did she react? What did she do? And we were then to apply it by focusing upon her reactions and her deeds and either seeking to imitate them ourselves or avoid them, depending on whether they are godly or sinful. No, instead, we need to be looking and understanding how God works in this passage, what he does, so that we can understand and see more of how he will be working in our lives today. So first, going back to the very beginning of this woman's life, rather than looking at how godly she is in showing hospitality to the prophet Elisha and applying that to ourselves and thinking, I must show hospitality to God's servants too, we should instead be noticing how God brings Elisha to her in the first place, thereby giving her the opportunity to serve him. It's not that I'm saying that we should not be showing hospitality, for we are told very clearly everywhere in the Bible to do exactly that. It is just that we need to go back one step and see how God operates in bringing to us opportunities to serve him. For it is God who directs Elisha's steps to Shunem. He's already taken notice of this woman and has plans for her. And that is a vitally important point for us as believers. For it's easy to place all the onus upon ourselves when it comes to following God. That somehow it's all about us seeking him, about us finding things to do for him, as if he were a passive or reactive force within our lives. But that is not so. God is working actively to grow us. So it is he who brings along this prophet to Shunem. And that action initiates a long line of crucially significant events in this woman's life. Now, I don't know how it all happened in Shunem as the prophet turned up in town, but I do know that one of the reasons God sent him there was the presence of this woman. And once the woman encountered the prophet, God laid it on her heart to take him in and feed him. And we need to be looking out for similar acts of God in our lives. For he is working in just the same way today, giving us opportunities to serve, bringing them to us. It will probably not take the same form. We are not to look for a travelling prophet to suddenly pop into our lives for us to show hospitality to. But he will be up to something, for that is what he does. He does not just leave us to get on with our lives as best we can. Things will happen. Serving opportunities will come. And when God-given events happen to us, we need to be able to recognise them and to respond. But as God brings us these opportunities to serve, we need to then seize them and run with them. Look at what the woman does. She not only gives Elisha his first meal, but she continues to feed him whenever he comes. And more than that, she has obviously been pondering in her heart how she can better grasp this opportunity from God. For she goes on to provide for the prophet more thoroughly by building him his study bedroom. And the same should be true for us. When God brings any opportunity to serve into our lives, we should not only take it, but look to do it as best we can, with all the abilities and resources we have, and seek ways that we can grow it. Think on those parables of the talents and the minas that Jesus tells. The point I'm trying to make is that our relationship with God is a two-way, active, living and dynamic process. He will be doing things in our lives, and we are to be doing things with our lives too. But we need to look for his works in order to respond to them with our actions. And it's important we get this the right way around. It is not for us to decide what we want to do, to then get on with it and expect him to bless it. And neither are we to sit on our backsides waiting for the right thing, in our view, to turn up before we start doing anything for him. We are to look out for whatever he brings and then pick it up and run with it. And he will bring something. So get looking around you. Start by asking God to bring you an Elisha, some opportunity to serve him, and ask him to help you recognize it when it comes, and then pick it up and run with it with all the gifts and abilities he's given you. For he will answer such prayers, for that is how he works and what he does. But then secondly, we need to be prepared for receiving his blessings. For as we get on with serving him, pursuing those opportunities that he gives us, so we will be blessed. And we can see this in the life of this Shunammite woman. For she really gets moving with her opportunity to serve, going from just one meal to a regular dinner to a B&B. And when the time comes, God decides, I'm going to bless her in all this. I'm going to honour the one who honours me. So he dispatches Elisha to her with a desire to bless. But the funny thing is, the woman is totally unprepared for it. She begins by rejecting the offer, thinking that she has all that she can have. And then when God opens up the possibility of having what she thinks she can't have, she just doesn't believe him. But God is a God who not only desires to bless those that serve him, is also a God who knows how to bless and can bless in ways we don't even think possible. And we need to believe that and expect that. Too often we limit God's power according to what we think is realistic, but he is capable of anything, and so we should expect anything. But again, we need to get it the right way around. We should not expect the blessing first and then the service second. Too often I've heard people say, oh, I will serve God once he has done this or that. Maybe he's cured this illness or given me that job or found that partner or put me in that position. No, the lesson of the Shunammite is get on with serving and the blessings will follow without you even seeking them. But then thirdly, we get something very different happening in her life. For the following event appears to be the very opposite of a blessing. For God's next act is to take away what is the very closest thing to her heart. For the death of her son is every bit as much the action of God as the receiving of him in the first place. And we must remember that ourselves as we face the opposite to blessing. For when those hard times come, and they come to us all, our first response should be to just sit down with God and acknowledge that it is he who has brought them. The woman of Shunem recognizes this, for she immediately set off to meet God in the person of the prophet Elisha. And notice what she does. She unburdens her grief to him and brings her problems before him. And we should be doing the same thing. Not in our case, bringing our griefs and problems to some human equivalent of Elisha, but as we've already learned, bringing them direct to God, for in Christ we no longer have a human intermediary. It is not wrong to feel grief. Jesus himself grieved with Mary and Martha at the death of their brother Lazarus. God is not going to be angry with our sorrow when we pour out our laments to him. Rather, in Jesus, he empathizes with our tears, and as our Father, he has compassion on us as his children. But we must marry our grief to our faith. For like this woman, we need to carry our burdens to him and just lay them at his feet. For we will not always know what can be done. In fact, often our problems can seem completely unsolvable to us. And we should learn to stop trying to tell God what to do in dealing with them and just present them to him and ask him to take the burden of them. For that is what he asks of us. And God does answer, in this particular case, by restoring the son to life. But you notice the path that our Shunammite has to walk to reach that point. It's not an instant and painless transition. She nurses her dying son for a whole morning. She has to travel from Shunem to Mount Carmel, a distance of about 20 miles, and then back. She then has to endure the failure of Gehazi and then wait in another room away from her son for Elisha. And for all those many hours, she would have had to endure the grief at her son's death and the fear that she will not see him again this side of her own death. An uncertainty probably made all the more acute by the possibility that he might be restored to her, knowing as she must the precedent of the widows of Zarephath's son, but at the same time not knowing if God will be willing to repeat such a unique event for her. And you know, we'll go through exactly the same. I think it is extremely unlikely that any of us will ever get to the point that we are free from such fears this side of heaven. For we will have to endure our fallen, untrusting hearts until we die. For while God uses these events to build our faith, and I have no doubt that is exactly what is going on here, we will never reach a state of perfect trust on this earth. That does not mean that such lessons as this don't work, For as we shall see next, the Shunammite's faith does indeed grow, but it will never become complete. We will never have perfect faith. And we must accept and expect as a result that we will go through times of extreme anxiety in our lives due to our lack of trust in our God. For every time a new situation arises, so our doubting hearts will find reasons to believe that God will not answer this time. I'm sure that if the following year the same thing had happened again and the boy had once more died, then his mother would have rushed off to Elisha with a little less of the fear than she had the first time. And then if it occurred again the next year, the fear would have decreased once more. And if it were to continue again and again, she may reach a point where there was no fear at all. But that is how we learn to trust God, seeing God act time and time again. But the problem is, the circumstances are not always the same. And so the fear is often fresh each time. And what God is seeking to build in us is a trust in all seasons, a trust that rises above difference, so that when a seeming calamity strikes, we say not, "Oh, this same thing happened last week, so I know that God will do it next, what God will do next," but rather, "This has never happened to me before, but I know that I have a God who is trustworthy because he has seen me through all these different calamities before. For he wants to prepare a people who are increasingly ready to face whatever he brings. For they are the sort of people who are most useful to him in his service." So we need to get our attitude right. We must prepare to face grief and with it fear. For our untrusting hearts are still weak. And so don't be surprised that we are called upon to endure our hours of hardship before the answer comes, as with the Shunammite and her son, or even the years of hardship. But at the same time, expect to grow in faith through all the changing challenges we face, for that is why God brings these very calamities. They come so that next time we might stand that little bit firmer, for we trust him that little bit more, and he will be able to use us to go for him that little yard further, and it'll be for us that little bit easier to do so. And that brings us to our fourth lesson from this woman's life. For the results of this process of faith growing can be seen in the next part of her story. For some time later, Elisha tells her that it's time to move. Now, this cannot have been an easy decision, for not only was she being asked to leave what to the Jew was the land of promise, the land of blessing, that she was very content. We know that she was very content in her hometown. But by this time in her life, she had learned to trust the God of Elisha to the extent that she was willing to go, to leave behind her home and to travel to a foreign land, and not just for an extended holiday, but for 7 years. Now, we're not told how she made ends meet in Philistia. We know that she was a wealthy woman, but how movable that wealth was in a country where it was often tied to agriculture and not in bank accounts, it's hard to say. But she goes. And in this, there is this fourth lesson for us. For there will be occasions in our lives where God asks us to do the unexpected. And not just the unexpected, but also the unexpected that we don't want to do. And this will take just as much trust as walking through those times of calamity. Indeed, we might see it as a time of calamity. For we cannot assume that God's plan for our lives is one that never involves sudden changes in direction. Now, that doesn't mean that we should expect to all move to another country during our lifetimes, for the changes God asks of us may well have nothing to do with an alteration in our hometown. But it may mean a complete change of career, or of how we use our leisure time, or just about anything. And we must make sure that we are never so set in our ways that we cannot trust God when he calls us to do something different. But there is often a wide gulf between our fond plans for our future and what God has in store for us. We are pieces on his chessboard to be moved as he sees best for the purposes of his kingdom, even if those purposes are at the same time in his infinite wisdom best for us too. So we must always be prepared for change in any part of our lives. For I'm sure that her move to Philistia was not on the radar of this rather stay-at-home Shunammite woman. But then look at the sequel, and that is our fifth lesson. And it is an absolutely classic lesson in how God cares for those who walk in his ways. For what happens next? Not only does she survive the years of famine, avoiding all the hardship that would have come with it if she'd stayed, and come through those 7 years in a foreign land, but when she returns, she finds herself not only getting back her old home and land, but she also receives a seven-year bonus so that she can come back to a position probably no worse off than if she'd stayed without the famine, and probably better off still, presuming that she had prospered in Philistia as well, which I think extremely likely, knowing the God who watched over her. And it is instructive for us to notice the way it all comes about. For all the players in this part of the story, no matter how powerful or lowly, are just puppets on the string of the God who controls all for the benefit of his people. Look at the king, who just happens to be taking a sudden interest in the deeds of the prophet Elisha. Now, this might not seem unlikely until you remember that all the kings of the northern kingdom, without exception, were hostile to the God whom Elisha served. And the actions of such a God through his prophet were not exactly top of their agenda. And then notice Gehazi, brought to just the right place at just the right time. And not only in terms of coming to talk to the king, but even more so in terms of exactly what part of the life of Elisha he's got to. That story of the raising of the Shunammite's son. And who should then walk in but the very subjects of that story. And so here we have a king, carried along by the pathos and glory of the tale, emotionally prepared to be generous in response, as Gehazi, carried along by his own eloquence, sees an unmissable opportunity to illustrate his point with the actual real thing. And so the king, in a glow of reflected glory, seeking to put the finishing touches to the tale of Elisha by inserting himself into the ending, gives the woman all that she could possibly have hoped for, and probably more so, as he restores her house, her land, and her revenue. And let us draw all the lessons we should from this conclusion. For here we have a blueprint for what God can do for those who serve him. Are we called to leave behind what we love in his service? Then he can be relied upon to care for us and provide for us beyond our expectations. Does he ask us to make sacrifices for him? Then we will find that those sacrifices are forgotten in the light of what he replaces them with. Is he asking us to step out in faith on a path that seems filled with difficulty, fear, and uncertainty? Then we will find that once we have taken that step, we will not be disappointed in how he holds on to us into the future. And of course, this is never more true in that first step that any person can take in response to the call of God. And that is a step to place all our lives into his care as we accept his Son, Jesus Christ, not only as our Saviour, but also as the Lord of our lives forever. So what do we learn from the life of this Shunammite woman? A character who has in many ways been a key figure in the ministry of Elisha. Well, as we saw at the beginning, she is a testimony to the grace of God in a time of godlessness. When the nation as a whole has rejected their God and lies not only under the signs of his grace, but also the signs of his judgment. But with all that as the backdrop, this woman shines like a bright beacon of hope for all believers in any time. But perhaps particularly in times such as those where the majority are walking in a very different direction. For she experiences God's grace, love and care in a way that is just not true of the bulk of the rest of her fellow countrymen. He sends his prophet into her life. He gives her opportunities to serve. He blesses her in her family life. He grows her in her faith. He rescues her in her calamities. He guides her in her life. He provides for her as she follows him. And he works in the lives of others to make sure hers continues to be blessed. And these things will be true of all those who follow him today. If we give our service to him when he asks, then we too will know his blessing, his growth, his provision and his care. And the extraordinary thing is that the lives of all those that reject him are still just as much under his authority as those who serve him willingly. And without even knowing it, he makes them servants to his will in his care of his children, as he did with Gehazi, the king, and his official. So let us trust this God with all our service. For he not only knows how to care for us, but more importantly, he has the power to care for us. Remember what Jesus says in Matthew 11, "Come to me, all who labour and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." For the yoke in that passage, that yoke of Jesus, is our service of him. But it is a service that brings true rest, for he delights in caring for us. As the psalmist knew well, in Psalm 18, he says, "He sent from on high, he took me, he drew me out of many waters. He rescued me from my strong enemy and from those who hated me, for they were too mighty for me. They confronted me in the day of my calamity, but the Lord was my support. He brought me out into a broad place. He rescued me because he delighted in me." Our God delights in all his children. Let us remember that and be encouraged to serve him. Let's pray. Father, I pray for us all. I pray that you would bring Elishas into our life. You would bring opportunities, clear opportunities that we can see, opportunities to serve whoever we are, the youngest to the oldest, the most important in the world's eyes to the least important, whatever it might be. You would bring these opportunities to serve. And Father, help us then to run with them, to serve you in faith and trust. And trust that you will care for us, bless us, you will look after us in all the ways you did with this Shunammite woman. Because you delight in your children that serve you. In Jesus' name, amen.